I'm Dustin Harder, and this is Keep On Cooking. Hello, and welcome to Keep On Cooking, the only podcast dedicated to plant-based cookbooks. I'm your host, Dustin Harder, and he makes my sauce simmer. It's my husband and producer of the podcast, David Rossetti. How you doing, honey?
It's me. I'm doing good.
Oh, Kenny, how good. Are you doing? I'm simmering over here.
You're simmering?
I'm on my way to a boil.
Favorite sauce?
My favorite sauce. I mean, I like, because I'm torn between just like a cream sauce or a marinara, really, is where I'm at. What about you?
I mean, I'm team marinara.
I love a marinara.
I love it because it's simple.
Yeah. I remember classic. In culinary school, one of the instructors just made a marinara from scratch, like super quick, and our minds were blown at how easy it was. We were like, what?
Yeah, it's so easy. It's so easy.
But I do love, I just did an arrabbiata for the new book I'm working on. And I love that. You actually liked it too. And you're not usually too into the spicy, I feel like.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was a good level of spice.
Good little balance, good little level for you. I've asked this of authors before, but I haven't asked you. And I feel like maybe I should know this. I wonder if we can guess. Okay, if we're out to eat and we're ordering spicy food, what, and the server says on a scale of 1 to 10, how spicy would you like it? What would you say I am?
Like what, a level?
Yeah, from 1 to 10, 10 being the spiciest.
7 for you?
Yeah, that checks. I'm going to say like 4 for you?
Yeah.
Is that too high?
No, that's pretty good.
Okay, because I know you still like a little something.
I like some spice. Like I like a nice like buffalo, like the heat from like buffalo.
Right. You do love a buffalo sauce. Huh. And like I feel that like that's little... more like that can be like an 8 sometimes, depending on the buffalo sauce.
Or like Frank's. I do love Frank's.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. Ooh, speaking of Frank's this week, I made that taco bowl earlier this week.
Ooh,
and I
yes.
sort of took a kick off of Ashley Madden. She was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We talked about her cauliflower tacos, and it was a mixture of, she does like Frank's Red Hot and then some spices on there. So I sort of did that again, only I did it with tofu and cauliflower, a little bit of Frank's Red Hot, and then a bunch of spices on it. What else do we have this week?
Well, we've been trying to be better. So our fridge kind of looks like a sweet green or a chopped.
Yeah, it looks like a little salad bar in there.
A little salad bar. I love it. Which is nice. Just kind of grab the stuff you want.
And that's a little tip from my fitness coach, Belinda Lagasse. Ooh. She's like, just make a sweet greens bar.
Friend of the pod.
So that you always got something going on in there that you can grab that's healthy. And it has saved us. It does get, I will say, after like 2 days, I'm like, I don't want a salad. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, you got to kind of like slip something in there for the week.
She also advocates, she's like, if you're sick of cooking and sick of meal prepping, and for me, like, it's more than that, right? I'm always recipe testing something, so like it goes beyond like the normal take care of yourself at home. She's like, she's a big advocate for like going and to Chopped or Sweet Green. She's like, treat yourself to the bowl, go get it if it means you're gonna get a healthful meal, which I love. She's like, you know, of course, if you can afford it. But anyway, I digress. So that's sort of, I dehydrated. You didn't get to try them because I ate them all.
Oh, y'all, we've got a new dehydrator. It's a new era.
We're in our dehydration era. We had a dehydrator for years and it did the trick. It did the job. Loved it.
Oh my God.
But the last time I put it in to make kale chips, I plugged it in. I mean, it was what's that brand? Excalibur, I think, is like their Excelsior. I don't know. Something like that. It's a good brand of dehydrators. But last time I plugged it in, the air was just
someone breathing. Like,
it's like we had put it to the test. We had, you know, we've moved it around the country.
Forever.
Yeah, we've done a lot with it. So I invested in a new one that I love.
Yeah,
I love it, love it, love it. And it's the Kasori brand, and it's just so easy to use. And we bought a cute little stand for it and everything. But I did apples last week. I did apple rings, and they were so tasty and yummy. And I did oranges. It's
easy to do, yeah.
Yeah, and I just loved it. And I've been taking even apple scraps. If I peel an apple, I'll put the peels in the dehydrator. So I have like little apple chips. Great way to use up food. We've got Max Lamana coming on the podcast too. Or we already had him. I don't know where this falls in the release, but he talks all about food waste and everything, or not wasting food rather. But anyways,
I love that.
Let's get on topic. We'll get to our guest that we have this week. I'm very excited about this one. Mm-hmm. She has become a beloved fixture on TikTok and Instagram. We're talking to Joanne Lee Molinaro, aka the Korean Vegan. I will say from this book, it's so exciting. It's so wonderful. So many amazing. David, you and I want to attack this book. But after I interviewed her, she was like, in the book, there's blueberry muffins. I was like, how did this end up in this book? She said, listen, I make the best blueberry muffins and I wanted it to be in here. And I was like, okay. So literally, I remember the day after I interviewed her, like I got off the call and I made the blueberry muffins.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, well, then I want these best blueberry muffins ever.
Immediately.
And they were the best blueberry muffins. But now this book, you know, it's I have so many cookbooks these days. We're doing so many interviews and I'm doing all the testing I'm doing myself. I don't get time to cook from these books, but there's so many things from this book that we want to make.
Gorgeous looking. Yes. And it's amazing. And you know, she's an internet sensation. She's got 5 million fans across her social media platforms. Yeah. She's made a name for herself in the vegan world and beyond. Molinaro started her blog, The Korean Vegan. So that's kind of how it started in 2016 after adopting a plant-based diet. So, and then in July 2020, she started her TikTok, The Korean Vegan, you know, mostly as a coping mechanism, as many of us did, something for the isolation due to the pandemic.
I did not start a TikTok in isolation. I did not do that. First of all, I was never isolated. Not in isolation. I didn't dabble till about a year ago. I was never in isolation. I went to work every gosh darn day. Anyways, she began posting content related to politics and life as a lawyer during quarantine. However, after a single post of making her Korean braised potatoes for dinner went viral, Molinaro shifted her attention to making 60-second recipe videos while telling stories about her family from North Korea.
So cool. So cool. And now she is a New York Times bestselling author and has appeared on the Food Network, CBS Saturday Morning, ABC's Live with Kelly and Ryan, The Today Show, PBS, and The Rich Roll Podcast. She also has her own podcast. So shout out. Are You Ready with Joanne Molinaro? Where she brings you weekly insights or bites.
Mm-hmm.
Wink, designed to help you live a more purposeful and empowered life.
Yes, and she's been featured in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, mm-hmm. the Atlantic, NPR, and CNN, and her debut cookbook was selected as one of the best cookbooks of 2021 by the New York Times and the New Yorker, among others, in addition to being honored as a James Beard Award recipient. And she's going to talk all about it all for us right now. Please welcome social media sensation, podcast host, and author of The Korean Vegan, Reflections and Recipes from Oma's Kitchen, Joanne Lee Molinaro. I'm officially dubbing her the Queen of Compassion, and you are most likely following this New York Times bestseller somewhere on social media under the moniker The Korean Vegan already. And if you're not, you will be after this. I'm obsessed, and you'll be too. Please welcome to the Keep on Cooking podcast, Joanne Molinaro. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be in the kitchen, if you will.
Yes. We're getting it done in the kitchen. We're going to start with your icebreaker question here. Do you have any hobbies currently? And if you don't have anything currently, is there a hobby you're hoping to pick up or one that you've had in the past that you really enjoyed? Hobbies. We're talking hobbies. What do you got?
I have so many hobbies like all the time that I'm always working on. But one thing that I'm really hoping to pick up is calligraphy, Chinese calligraphy. Ooh. Yeah. My mother has been studying Chinese calligraphy basically her whole life. And she really doubled down on that once she retired a few years ago. And she is such a talented calligraphist. In fact, one of my tattoos is her calligraphy design. And so I told her when I come home in a couple of weeks, she and I were just going to sit down at the table and she's going to teach me how to do it.
Oh, that's great. Teach the basics, I would imagine, yeah, right?
Very much.
Like how to be make... like, yeah, the practice of it comes in, which is always the part I struggle with everything. Exactly. My hobby, so I've had a guitar. It sits over in my living room area. I've had it for a decade.
And I picked it up when I first got it. I was like, okay, good. Look, I can play like some chords. This is great. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't touch it for 10 years. And then I just started guitar lessons again in December. But then I dropped them beginning of this month because my life was crazy. I mean, I guess that's hobbies, right? But like, that is the one that I want to get back into. That's my hobby there.
I love that. I think that with guitar, it can be very challenging because you feel like you're making no progress for a really, really long time. And then it also hurts, right?
Yes.
But I do remember one week when I learned guitar, this is many years ago, I just literally did nothing but play guitar for like 1 week. And then, you know, I had the calluses and it was amazing. Like once I had that 1 week under my belt, it was much easier to like learn chords and tabs and, you know, download the tabs and do all that. But it does take like 1 week of like intense. Do nothing else.
So do you play guitar then?
I do. I love that. It's funny because you would know this, my nails are often longer and manicured for videos and mm-hmm. cookbook photographs and the like. And so it's hard for me to play guitar. And I also play violin. It's hard for me to play violin with longer nails. So when I cut them, like I have right now, I'm just like, okay, now's my chance.
I'm gonna play. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I always wonder, you know, Dolly Parton just does magic on a guitar with those fingernails. And I'm like, that's gotta be the skill where suddenly you're like, well, if my nails were cut, I wouldn't know how to play.
You know? Yeah, no, you really have to bend your fingers like completely differently to do it that way.
Just crazy. Well, one day I was going to say we'll get together and jam, but I don't think I'll ever be to that point.
We'll cook together than jam.
Yeah, that sounds a little more appropriate. Well, I'm honored to have you here. You're so gracious to give us your time, and I know you're very busy with all you have going on, and you have millions of fans from around the globe that follow the Korean Vegan. You're a storyteller. You don't just share recipes and photos. You tell stories with your food, and I can literally just sit and watch your TikTok like I'm watching TV. I love it so much. And this book, this New York Times bestseller and James Beard award-winning book, is gorgeous, filled with stories of you and your family and the food that shaped your family's history. Please give our listeners a little overview, a little summary of the book before we get started.
Well, I think, Dustin, you just gave like the best summary. But that really is. I mean, I would say like 90% of the book are filled with recipes that are essentially like veganized versions of Korean food that I grew up eating. And then the rest of it is sort of like a smattering of like fusion recipes. My husband's Italian American, so there's a lot of like what I call Italian vegan food. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there's just like some like random things where I'm like, I just really love blueberry muffins and I think that mine are better than anywhere else I've ever eaten. So here you go, now that it's also yours. And stuff like that. But as you allude to, kind of woven throughout the cookbook are stories about my past, about my parents' past, where they came from, how they arrived in America. And really, it's designed to give a little bit of a peek inside maybe a different kind of American family than many might be used to seeing on television or having experienced on their own. And also, you know, I didn't think of this at the time I wrote it, but it's also meant to help people who have had untraditional or unconventional families in America feel a little bit seen, like, oh, this is beautiful. This is a beautiful story. It's relatable. And it makes me feel a little bit more comfortable that my own family may not be like what you see on an after-school sitcom.
Yeah, I love that. It also made me think truly about history of food. Like, I mean, while it is a representation of your family and history and cooking in that sense, like just history of food, it really made me like stop and pause now. I'm like, oh, I'm going to think about like this thing that I'm making now, like really, where was it created and what's the origin of it? So I love that. And you started the blog, The Korean Vegan, in 2016. And just to mention to everyone, she was also a full-time lawyer at the time. Is that correct?
Yes.
She was lawyering about, yes. Is that a word? We'll make it a word today. What was cooking for you up until that point? Had you cooked much up until that point? And when did veganism come into play with it?
Right. I had not cooked very much. A lot of my cooking consisted of meat that should have been cooked, but ended up being raw. I was not a very good cook. I did watch a lot of Rachel Ray and the Food Network. And I think it was because I was really stressed out about law school and my job as a junior associate. That's like probably one of the most stressful careers one can ask for. Mm-hmm. And I found something incredibly soothing about the kind of like thoughtlessness of just Food Network TV. Like I didn't have to really pay attention, but it was like almost like a friend was like in my kitchen, kind of like chattering away while cooking. And I really liked that. And I think through that process, I learned a lot about the fundamentals of cooking, just like this is how you sear something. This is how you saute. Salt is important. Salt your pasta water, like things like that, that I really didn't learn from anyone else. When I went vegan in 2016, it became much more urgent for me that I get a handle on my kitchen skills because I, number one, at that time in 2016, though it was much better than 2006, it wasn't like there was a plethora of vegan options for me at restaurants. So I had to learn to cook. But I think more importantly, I was so threatened by veganism, you know, probably in a very uninformed way, thinking, oh, well, you know, veganism is going to take my Korean-ness for me. So I need to learn how to make Korean food vegan. And I like basically cooked like two Korean dishes in my life up until that point. So it became sort of like a crash course on YouTube. Like I was like sitting there watching Mungchi like 24/7 and then trying to figure out ways to veganize all of these dishes that I had grown up eating and taken for granted.
Wow. And when you start, you're learning how to cook Korean essentially and cook vegan at the same time. These worlds are coming together. Is there you're saying YouTube, but I'm curious. I ask every author if there is a cookbook, a vegan cookbook when they first went vegan, or even a blog, I suppose, but like something that resonated with you the most or that you turned to again and again that sort of helped you out.
Honestly, no. I wish I could say that there was, but there was certainly no Korean vegan cookbook at the time. And I would imagine that there would have been helpful cookbooks, but they would have been in Korean. Because, you know, there's this very long history of temple food in Korea, which is essentially plant-based Korean food, which I didn't even know existed at the time. But I'm sure there are a lot of cookbooks like that in Korea, but they are not translated into English. And I, you know, while I can read very perfunctorily and, you know, Korean not well enough to, you know, follow a cookbook or even a blog. And so there really wasn't a lot. I know Mommy Tang was on YouTube and she had some recipes, but by that time she had really transformed into a mukbang kind of vlogger as opposed to a cookbook recipe developer. So I was pretty much on my own. I did kind of rely on a lot of different random blogs, I would say. Like none of them like stick out as one that I would return to like frequently. I do remember I used Serious Eats a lot because Kenji Lopez-Alt, he did this thing where he went vegan for a month every year. And during that month, he would develop all of these vegan recipes. And I did like go back to him a couple of times because he does undertake a fairly scientific approach to a lot of his recipes. And I liked that methodology a lot because it taught me so much more about not just whatever recipe he was making, but the process that he undertook, kind of the ingredients and the substitutions that came up a lot through his study of veganizing traditionally non-vegan cuisine. So if anyone, like, I would go back to that blog for its vegan recipes. But, you know, most of the time, Dustin, I would just take a non-vegan recipe and just kind of veganize, like go with my gut and say, I think I'll do this, you know?
Yep, that makes sense because I was thinking too, since you were trying to do very specific things, it would make sense. You would probably look at a recipe that you wanted to veganize and then just find ways to veganize that one. So you weren't following one cookbook or one YouTube or anything like that. So that makes sense. Well, I'm excited to dig into this book. Let's dive right into the Korean Vegan Reflections and Recipes from, say it for me.
From Amma's Kitchen.
From Amma's Kitchen. You start this book off with a very vivid picture of your family eating at the table and how talking was discouraged during mealtime. You say, I don't remember any pleasantries like what happened at school today or how was work, honey? We didn't spill our guts during dinner. We filled them. Can you speak more to that?
Yeah, I remember... You know, I would watch Family Ties and Growing Pains, and like that was the television of my childhood. And I just remember, like, gosh, when these people eat dinner together, they're so talkative. They're like talking about school, like, what did you do at work? And I remember one time I tried to talk like at dinner time, and like my grandma yelled at me. And so I was like, okay, well, I guess that's how it is, a very serious time. And because of that, like, dinner time was not a long affair. It was like 15, 20 minutes, you know. It would take much more time to prepare the food than to actually enjoy the food. And it definitely felt like, no, this is serious time. Like, you need to be filling your bodies, and, you know, no time for silliness or, mm-hmm. you know, there are so many different words that my grandmother would use for like, this is not necessary. This is silly. You know, stop wasting time. Don't waste food. That was another big mm-hmm. thing. And so that was sort of the kind of intention I felt like of our meals. And in retrospect, I mean, at the time, I just thought it was yet another annoying difference between my life and, you know, Growing Pains. But, right. you know, in retrospect, I completely understand it. My grandmother and my parents both went through so much of their lives without enough food mm-hmm. on their table. So, of course, it absolutely was a serious thing for them. And it was something that required focus and attention yeah. as opposed to distraction.
And it was very intentional. It was a very intentional moment to be eating the food.
Yeah. Like they, you know, so much of it was like, don't waste your food. Mm-hmm. Focus on, you know, filling your bodies with the nutrients that we have provided. And also Korean food, it's not as, I think, in some ways easy to eat as like, I think, Western food, where you have a fork and a knife and you have everything on one plate. In Korean cuisine, you get one bowl of rice and then you have 15 other plates on the table. You know, they're called banchan. You'll mm-hmm. often have a stew and, you know, all these other things. And so there's, you know, I kind of talk about in the beginning of the book, there was this choreography to it. There were these sounds and there was music to it and there was a rhythm to it. And none of it was ever punctuated with our voices. Mm-hmm. It was like just the sounds from eating dinner. And that is a very vivid memory for me.
And your husband's Italian, right?
Yes.
So you get around that dinner table. I'm just realizing that is a difference. That is like two different ends of the spectrum. I mean, mangia, everyone's yes. just eating and like just talking, I would imagine.
It then. Is. It's so great. And I love hanging out with his family because it is so different from mine.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of joy that always prevails around their dinner table. Joy and emotion, I think, mm-hmm. is probably a better way of describing it. I was in Rome about a month and a half ago, and half his family still lives in Rome. And we were at his Zia Menica's house, and you know, all her children were there, all her grandchildren there. One of her great-grandchildren was there, and it was us. We were the special guests. And it's just this wonderful raucousness that kind yeah. of, you know, encircled her dining table. We had a baby crying in the corner, yeah. you know, and one of Anthony's cousin was just going on a rant about her trip to London. And, you know, there was wine everywhere and, yeah. you know, gnocchi and, you know, pasta fagioli and pizza, and it's just amazing. And I love that because I'm not saying that I prefer that to the tables that I grew up around, but it's just a different experience. Mm-hmm. And I love filling my life with that.
Yeah. How many, when you say, you know, the kids and the grandkids, how many do you remember like what number that was? How many people that was? Was it a lot of people?
No, it wasn't a lot. I mean, it was 1, 2, 3. She has 3 children and they have grandchildren. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I would say like around 10.
Okay.
10. Yeah.
I thought you were adding on to the 5 there for a minute and it got up to like 15. And I was like, no, I'm going to stop you. That's a lot. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I got it.
Yeah.
You visited South Korea during the summer 2019, and you met with a Buddhist monk and cook, and you refer to her as the OG Korean vegan. Can you tell us about her and meeting her?
Yes. So Jeonggwan Sunim is a Buddhist nun or monk. She was actually featured in the season 3 premiere of Chef's Table. Okay. And I had heard of her prior to then, but just prior to that episode came out. And you know, she's been written about by some of the great food writers of our generation in the New York Times and all over the place, right? And she's often referred to here in the United States as one of the most exquisite chefs in the world. And at the time, I remember thinking, wow, non-vegans in America are calling a Korean vegan chef one of the greatest chefs in the world. Not greatest vegan chefs, just greatest chefs, yeah. You know? And I just like, I have to meet her because she's like, she's my mentor. She's, you know, I've already adopted her as my mentor, even though I hadn't met her at the time.
She doesn't know it, but she is.
She will know it one day. That's what I, and I, you know, this is very early on in my vegan journey. I think it must've been 2016 or 17. And everyone's veganism evolves over time. I certainly had, but I thought everything was about Instagram and blogging and YouTubing. And so I finally had a chance to meet her in 2019. And I was really excited about my Instagram account, and I showed it to her and I was like, but you're the originals. and she was very kind. But she was also kind of like, oh, how cute. You're so cute. Your Instagram account's so cute. And in retrospect, again, I realize now, that how else could she have reacted to me being excited about my Korean vegan Instagram account? For her, it wasn't an Instagram account. It was her life. Yeah. It was, you know, part of every decision that she makes, not just her diet. Right. Every decision that she makes on a daily basis is guided by compassion. Mm-hmm. And that really taught me so much about the power of compassion and how under-inclusive my veganism was until that point.
Wow. Wow. You talk about it in this book and a couple of times throughout the book, I feel like. So it's great to hear that story from you. And and you give, as we get into the food of it, you give an overview of the Korean vegan pantry in this book, and you talk in depth about some familiar items people might know, like soy sauce and sesame oil and dried mushrooms. Can you elaborate maybe on a couple of pantry items that you think are less familiar to people that you know people will love once they have in their pantry?
I can't predict that they will love it, but I will say, you know, the book has been out for what now, over a year. Mm-hmm. And one of the most popular recipes in the book, which was a huge surprise to me, is the spicy doenjang jjigae. And doenjang is the main ingredient, as the name suggests. And doenjang is fermented soybean paste. Fermented soy is probably the backbone of Korean cuisine. A lot of people think it's kimchi, and certainly kimchi definitely has its role, but you're going to find fermented soy in almost everything that we make. And so fermented soybean paste, doenjang, if you look at it, you're going to be like, I don't know if I want to put that in my food, Joanne. But it's something that you can find in a Korean grocery store. You will have trouble finding it, quite frankly, in a non-Asian grocery store, but you will be able to find it pretty readily at an Asian one. And it's very similar to gochujang, which is now becoming a fairly, you know, prevailing condiment, even in Western grocery stores. Mm-hmm. Gochujang is also a fermented soybean paste, but it's red and it's very spicy because it has gochugaru, which is Korean pepper powder or Korean chili powder. Doenjang is not red. It's brown. And I often liken it to miso, only because that is a flavor that I think many non-Koreans are familiar with. Oh, I've had miso soup before, you know, at my hibachi place or at my sushi place. It's like a very, very, very intense, concentrated, strong, you know, flavor that will remind you of miso, which is sort of like a milder version of that. Now, as I talk about in the book, the fermentation process is very different for those two things. And, you know, sometimes I hesitate to compare, but because there's really no other reference point that I think many non-Koreans have when it comes to understanding this flavor, that is what I use. And like I said, I was surprised because it is an intense flavor and it's got an intense sort of funky smell, but it is like one of the runaway recipes from my cookbook. I see it posted all the time, especially in winter because stews are so popular in winter. And that does make me quite happy. It makes my mom very happy as well.
Oh, I love it. Well, I'll have to check it out. I'll have to put that in my pantry. Yeah. And chapter one is our basics chapter. I love a basics chapter because I feel like the home cook really gets some tools that they can put into play in the book. But then once they realize they like those basics, they can sort of keep them on hand as a staple and use them again and again in their own creations, which is always fun. And you open with rice and have a story of your father being upset with you and how you prepared the rice, or as you called it, the rice rage. What are some tricks to preparing the perfect rice?
You know, I wish I could say something non-pedantic, but honestly, like with rice, it's just practice. Like it's kind of like bread. You know, I was just looking through a manuscript for a sourdough book that I'm really excited is going to be coming out later this year. And like his basic sourdough recipe. And I'm looking through it because I'm like, oh yeah, what's the hack here? You know? And he's like, you got to, you know, pretty much make this like 18 to 20 times before you really get the knack of it. I mean, and he was very honest about it, you know?
No hack there. No hack there. Just
practice. It's not a hack. It's just practice. And I think that with rice, it's very similar. I provide kind of my favorite rice blend, and it does have, you know, kind of multiple different kinds of grains in them to give you that texture and to give you that feeling of heartiness. A lot of times when I show my rice on a recipe, people are like, ooh, what's in your rice? That looks so good. And it is good. It's really delicious. But in order to get that right ratio of water to grain, it depends on your rice cooker. It depends on whether you're cooking it on the stovetop or in a rice cooker. Mm-hmm. You know, it can depend on a lot of different things. It could depend on the humidity of your house, even just like with bread. And while I give measurements, which kind of are my go-to measurements, mm-hmm. I always use the hand trick. But unfortunately, the size of my hand is not the same as yours. So it's kind of one of those things. And, you know, I talk about in my book, hey, if you're looking for hacks, like maybe this isn't the book for you.
Sure.
You know, I don't give you hacks. I don't give you substitutions. I give you a lot of information that you can then take to your own kitchen and do with what you will. But this wasn't a book that was meant to be like, heck your way through Korean vegan food, you know?
Yep. It's one of the things I love about the book though, because you do, it's educational. It's, and I think different books serve different purposes, right? For people trying to get a meal on the table weeknight vegan, and they're brand new to it and like terrified of vegetables. Sure. There's a quick and easy book for that. But if someone's trying to really learn some tools and really learn some history too, this book is nailing it for that. But also, like we said, we got some basics that people, once they learn how to make them, they're going to have them. You've got some great stuff in this chapter. We got vegetable broth. We have almost Korean barbecue sauce, fishy sauce, spicy soy sauce dressing, spicy gochujang dressing, and the cold barley tea for me. How do you pronounce the cold barley tea?
Poricha.
Poricha. Mm-hmm. What's one of the basics from this chapter you always have on hand still?
Yeah, so I would say the spicy garlic dressing, spicy soy sauce garlic dressing, or I always get the name wrong of my own recipes, but but it's something I literally have in my kitchen 24/7. Like I never do not have that sauce at some point. And it's at like various degrees of curing, if you will. So like this one's been here for 1 week. This one's been here for 2 months, you know?
Yep.
And I do love that because it does get so much more concentrated over time. And the vegetables inside, you know, during the first 3 days, the carrots will be still crunchy and like, you know, really bright orange. And the 2 month one, you'll be like, there was carrots in here. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that I use so often to braise my tofu, to really spice up a jjigae, or you know, the other day I was making some kimchi noodles and I was like, oh, I'll just use my sauce instead of regular old soy sauce. And the great thing about it is like, look, if you don't want to make it, you don't have to. You can just replace this with regular soy sauce, your favorite soy sauce if you want. But if you want something with a little bit more zip, with a little bit more flavor, with something that's been sitting in your fridge and you know you can go to at any time, what a great tool to have. And you'll see it kind of popping up throughout at various points, you know, in various other recipes throughout the book. And that's why I have the basics chapter, because I always say, read through this before maybe you go through some of the other ones so that you don't get frustrated. But in, again, like even with the vegetable broth, we often say, look, this is the best vegetable broth you're ever going to make. It's delicious and it's very Korean. But if you don't want to spend time over, you know, a pot of steaming vegetables, fine. Then go ahead and just buy your own vegetable broth.
Yeah. Yeah. You can take whatever road you want. That's the best part of when you're cooking in your own home. Chapter two is breads. And when I turned to this chapter, I immediately thought, is bread big in Korea? And you address that right away. You mentioned you'll still really rarely see bread at a traditional Korean restaurant these days. But where are places that you'll see bread then in Korea?
So in Korea, you'll see bread everywhere because these little Korean cafes, kind of like if you go to New York City's K-Town, or even if you go to LA's K-Town for sure. But in a lot of these bigger cities in the United States now, you'll see things called pari baguette, which is a Korean style cafe. You'll see, I can't remember the other one, Trey's Luce du Jour or something like that. Mm-hmm. You'll see those as well. And they're kind of inspired by the Korean interpretation of French patisseries or confectionaries. A lot of the little cakes in there will look a little like they'll be that looks like a croissant, but it's sure. smaller, yeah. You know, so it's a very Korean take on French pastries and things like that. Unfortunately, in Korea, as I don't know if I mentioned this in the book, for some reason, they put butter and eggs in everything, even things that traditionally do not have butter and eggs in them. So it's very hard as a vegan to really enjoy the Korean cakes and pastries sure. that you see in Korea. So, and that's including the breads, which yeah. like makes me crazy. I'm like, you're not supposed to put milk in a baguette.
Yeah.
So I love the bread chapter. I love baking bread. I love baking period, but bread in particular. And so that's why I wanted to, I was like coming up with all these recipes and my editor and were like, you have enough breads in here just to make its own chapter. And I'm like, well, let's do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's pull that into a chapter then. And I love, you give us, you know, the Korean version of everything in here. You give us the how it's spelled. And can you as I get to each chapter, how do you say bread then?
Bang, bang.
Bang. Okay.
Yeah. And I love bang. But you're right, like as I say, like you will never see bang in a traditional Korean restaurant.
Sure.
We do not have those kinds of things. But you know, Korean people love bang.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's universal. I think everyone, you know, so good, so tasty. And I have my eye on the red bean paste bread, braided challah bread with sweet red bean paste sprinkled with sea salt and sesame seeds. It looks so yummy. And what's a bread in this chapter you would tell someone to make? Or a bong in this chapter you would tell someone to make who just picked up the book?
I would say the focaccia, the perilla leaf focaccia, or you don't even have to put perilla leaves on it. You could just make the bread. It's so good. I have made that focaccia recipe. I can make it in my sleep. I've made it so many times. A lot of times I'll bring it to dinner parties. And I remember once I was bringing it to a Christmas dinner party and I was in the elevator of my building. I lived in a condo at the time. And the people in the elevator, they looked at me and they're like, what are you holding? It smells so good. Can we have some? And that's oftentimes the reaction I get when I unveil the focaccia mm-hmm. and they can smell yeah. just, you know, the aroma of it. I mean, focaccia is hard to not like. And that's a very easy version. There are a lot of more complicated focaccia recipes out there. I like this one because it's very simple. It's very straightforward and it always turns out good.
Do you put potato in your focaccia?
Not in this recipe.
Okay.
I think that adding potato can add a layer of complication for novice sure. bread makers
sure.
because then you are sort of messing with the water, you know,
yeah, yeah.
flour ratio. I have made potato focaccia bread. It is delectable. Like,
sure.
It's like dissolves in your mouth in that wonderful way. But not this one. This one's kind of straightforward.
Okay. I love that. Well, not that it's a cookbook on hacks, but I taught a class in Chicago, actually, where you're from, but I taught a class at the Chopping Block. Are you familiar with
the
Chopping Block?
Yeah, I took cooking classes from there.
So I've taught classes there on and off before the pandemic and then now after. But one of the chefs that was helping me set up, I was talking about my wisdom tooth had just been pulled and I had to have instant mashed potatoes, which I don't think I've ever had in my life. But I said, but I was surprised they weren't that bad. She was like, yeah, and if you're doing something like making focaccia bread, like you, and I was like, oh my gosh, that is like the best hack I've ever heard of in terms of like, if you have to add potato to something, because if not, it is like an extra labored step where I'm like, oh, there's potato in it. Maybe I won't make it. You know?
No, I totally agree with you. Mashed potatoes actually, it's such a great combination with flour on so many, you can make, mashed potato pancakes, or jeon in Korean. And, you can make certainly potato breads. You can make gnocchi. I mean, there's like, it's endless, but I love potatoes. So yeah. I can always find an excuse for adding potatoes to something.
Yeah, me too. And I don't mind making them usually either. I was just, loopy on wisdom tooth drugs. So I was like, to my husband, I was like, can you just make me get a box of instant mashed potatoes? And they were vegan too. So you mentioned the, perilla leaf, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about what that is?
Yeah. So genyip, it's what it's called in Korean, is genyip. And we ate genyip all the time growing up. And usually it was just like in two forms. It was just raw, literally freshly picked from our backyard, because we always had genyip in our backyard. I think my mom still has genyip in her backyard. And it would be kind of like, how people use bib lettuce or lettuce for a lettuce wrap, just replace that with a huge genyip leaf. And it's just got this wonderful kind of like, I don't know like what the flavor, but it's got an herby flavor, but much milder than mint or basil, or some of the other herbs that many people are familiar with. It's just a very mild flavor. The other way, of course, we eat genyip is we'll ferment it or pickle it, whatever you want to call it. We'll cure it with soy sauce and garlic. And basically, I just take the spicy garlic soy sauce dressing of the basics chapter and cure the genyip with a little bit of that. And that's wonderful. But because it has such a unique flavor and a mild one, I think that it's great for things like adding to bagels or focaccia bread, or even adding to stews. You'll see it come up in some of the stews that we make for our stews chapter. It's a very versatile and I think durable herb. Unfortunately, if you don't grow it yourself, they're very difficult to find other than in a Korean grocery store.
It's very pretty too. In the photos, it's just a beautiful, beautiful leaf. I was like, gosh, that makes that just pop so much. It's gorgeous. We also have seaweed sesame bagels in here, milk bread, and stone pot bread. Chapter 3 brings us to side dishes. Banchan, am I saying that correctly?
Banchan, yes, banchan. Very good.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned at the top of this chapter that the hallmark of a Korean dining table is the number of banchan, or side dishes. And there's several tasty ones in this chapter. If you could bring a few of these dishes to the table, right? If you were just wanted to impress people, bring a few dishes to the table and set it up. What are a few dishes from this chapter that you would bring to the table?
Well, there are two that I make all the time, especially for dinner parties when I know I'm having someone over for dinner and they're excited to eat Korean vegan food. And the two that I make most often are geuranmari, which is the Korean omelet. And, Korean people, they're not thinking, oh, I can only eat egg for breakfast. this omelet is very much a Korean staple for banchan, which you have breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then the other one is gamja jorim, which is the braised potato dish. These are two that I make all the time, possibly because my husband's probably like his favorite food is geuranmari. Like he's like, I can eat this all the time. And then, gamja jorim, my husband and I are both athletes. We're long distance runners, and healthy carbs, very, very important, especially before a long run. And so these potatoes, because they're braised, they're not fried or roasted. They're essentially, like steam and boiled. So it's a very healthy way of preparing it. And again, if you have that spicy dressing that I mentioned in the basics on hand, it's like the easiest thing to make ever. You chop up a handful of vegetables and potatoes, dump some of that dressing in, and then cook it for like 20 minutes and you're done.
So good. I love. So we've got the braised potatoes, right, that we're bringing to the table. Did you mention one before that as well?
Yeah. So the geuranmari, which is the Korean style omelet. And
that's right.
Yeah.
What makes it Korean style?
So I'm not very familiar with the Western omelet, so it's hard for me to completely compare, because I hate it. eggs growing up. This is the only way my mom could get me to eat eggs when I was little. And, you know, as a vegan, I'm like, well, why eggs? They're full of cholesterol and fat. You know, but again, my parents were wartime children. So for them, egg was like the most nutritious food, right? Like, oh, there's protein and fat. And, you know, that was everything that they didn't have growing up. So growing up, they were like, oh, you got to eat more eggs. And I was like, I hate eggs. But my mom would make me these kiramari, which is essentially like, you take an egg and you roll it up kind of like a crepe. Mm-hmm. And then you slice them into small pieces. And so that you have this beautiful, exactly, you get this lovely, like almost lamination that happens from the rolling of it.
Okay.
And it's just like a little bit, I don't know, it just seems like less overwhelming than like a whole big omelet. You don't have to eat the whole thing. You could just have a couple pieces. In fact, if you're a polite person and you're eating it with, you know, people at dinner, you would only take one or two pieces so that there are enough for everyone else at the table.
Uh-huh. Can you believe that opened right to that page? Look at that. Universe was like, look at that.
You have to make it.
Yes. Yes. Everyone, if you're just listening and not watching, you can go watch the podcast. We just went right to that omelet. It opened right up. The mung bean pancakes are calling my name. And we've got the roasted glazed onions, doenjang. Is that right?
Doenjang is that ingredient I mentioned in the beginning that I was surprised that people really took a liking to.
All right. So we've got it with the roasted glazed onions here, battered squash, braised lion's mane mushrooms, tofu cake. So many great things in this chapter. So a lot to bring to the table for the banchan. Yes. And chapter 4 is kimchi and salads. And the story at the top of this chapter is about the secret ingredient of kimchi. And everyone listening, I'm emotional now, just like, so this book is a journey, honeys. It is a journey. Like I'm reading it and, you know, I'm writing my notes and I'm doing my thing. And then suddenly I'm like, everything needs to stop and I'm going to focus on this story. It's one of the many moments reading this book that my eyes welled up with tears. And, you know, the secret is that tomorrow's kimchi is tastier because it's brined by yesterday's kimchi. And just reading that, can you speak to this and the story you tell here in the book?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, just kind of surface level, I think that's just a cooking methodology that probably many people who ferment or cure ingredients, not just Koreans, you know, like I remember I was reading a book by Jeff Gordinaire and, you know, he was talking about cuisine from South America where many of the mole sauces, you know, the sauces that they're, you know, known for, well, they keep a little bit of, you know, the, you know, prior version of that sauce to help make the second batch. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes every subsequent batch unique. Like there's unique, but there's a little bit of the past kind of still in that sauce. And it's the same idea with kimchi is, you know, and I do this, I don't want it like disgusting, but I also don't like go out of my way to like scrub down each kimchi pyeong, you know, or each kimchi jar. I save some of the leftover kimchi juice, that fermentation, if I haven't made a jjigae out of it. And I use that for the subsequent batch of kimchi because that lactic acid, I mean, that's going to help with the fermentation. But I think, you know, that story I talk about my grandma and I remember this so vividly. We'd walk into my garage and there would always be just like a line of, you know, kimchi pyeongs, you know, empty ones. Cause all of the ones that were filled, they would be in the fridge if they hadn't just been put in the jars, because you do want to leave it outdoors as opposed to in a fridge for a couple days. And so all the kimchi was in the fridge, but there would always be like this line of kimchi pyeongs in the garage. And this idea of, well, these are the same ones that we've always, always, always used for decades because you're leveraging, you know, all of the, you know, microbiota that was inside of each jar to optimize the fermentation and the flavor of each subsequent jar. And of course, you know, the deeper meaning, which is the message of the book, the heart of the book is, look, I'm a vegan. I'm not making dishes that my grandma made for me. You know, like these are iterations of dishes that my grandmother made for me. My grandmother wasn't vegan. She's very vegetable forward, but she mm-hmm. wasn't vegan. Mm-hmm. And so this idea is like, hey, your next batch of kimchi isn't going to be identical as the one that came before it, but I can take its essence, its spirit, its core, to make sure that everything that I make subsequent to that is still sort of related back to that original one. And that's really what the heart of this book is about, is, you know, the heart of cooking is so much about the stories and the love and the sonmat, which is a Korean phrase for like the ingredient of the hand, you know, like the person who's making the food, that very unique mm-hmm. ingredient that nobody else can really put into it. That all goes into making the most delicious food you ever can.
Mm-hmm. The ingredient of the hand. That's so true, because it is, it really, you can have all the best ingredients in the world, but it really is dependent on the hands.
Yes.
that are putting it together and the love that's going into it. I like how, well, we're talking about kimchi. I like how you speak to the rules of making kimchi. And I love that you put it this way. You say they're bendy. The rules are bendy. And I love a good technique that's bendy with some wiggle room for interpretation. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think just like everything else, it's all about taste, you yeah. know? And kimchi is such a great example of that, because I think many people think that there's like one or two maybe kinds of kimchi, but mm-hmm. there's like hundreds of different kinds of kimchi. And the reason for that is because people have varied tastes. You know, some like theirs without a lot of spice in it, so that you have the white kimchi, or what I call water kimchi is one of the recipes in the book. There's hardly any spice in it. It's just a couple of peppers, right? But other people, they really like it spicy, and they also like it pretty intense in flavor. So they'll ferment it way longer than maybe I would. Yeah. I like mine at about the 2.5 to 3 week mark, but some people are like, no, I got to wait for about 6 weeks. I want it almost brown in color,
things
like that. So I think that there is room for subjectivity. There's room always for taste in food, but there are some things that I learned from my family, particularly my Waesungmo, who I talk about in the book, that I think help to give you room for that flexibility. Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about the variations, there's someone you mentioned, you were like, someone you know likes it like rancid, essentially.
My cousin, yeah.
But yeah, not me. That's like, I'm not on that end either. I'm like, woo! But I know people do. Some people do. They love it.
They're like,
way.
The smellier the better. And I'm like, okay, I like it this smelly.
yep, exactly. Well, there's lots of kimchi and salads in here. This is probably a big question here, but what's your favorite kimchi to make from this book, or one that you make the most often?
Ooh, you know, it used to be ponytail kimchi, that's chonggak kimchi. I love chonggak kimchi because I like very crunchy texture. Okay. But I have to say, over the past few years, maybe it's because I'm getting older and turning into my mom, I don't know. I really do just love the traditional pitchu kimchi recipe that I have in there. It's a very traditional, straightforward approach to kimchi with a little bit of like kind of my, you know, bent towards sweeter kimchi, I would say. And we use persimmons instead of apple pears for the sweetness. I use brown rice syrup instead of sugar because I have a hard time using sugar in my savory recipes.
Sure.
And I can use maybe a slightly healthier, you know, option. Yeah. So other than that, it's a very straightforward recipe. I made it a couple of months ago, right before I left for Italy. Actually, I made it in December, which is often the traditional time to make kimchi, is November and December when it's cold outside. And I still have just a tiny little bit left from the amount I made. And it's phenomenal. It's such good kimchi. And I'm very proud of that recipe. And I love that I'm now at a point in my life where whenever somebody comes over for dinner, I'm just like my mom, and I always have a little plate of kimchi to serve.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Well, and what about salads for this? Do you have a go-to salad in this chapter?
I would say the pear slaw is probably one of my favorites.
Delicious. I don't know what it is about that pear and slaw. When you say that, I'm like, that sounds amazing.
I love slaw. I think that is probably because I grew up eating kimchi. Sure. So I like eating things that are, you know, slightly pickled, you know, with a little bit of salt, but retains that sort of crunch, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I love slaws, and that pear slaw I came up with because I was like, oh, I love slaws. And I have like 10 pitch or, you know, pear, which is Korean pear, in my fridge. And I'm like, well, why don't I make a slaw out of this? Because I always think of, I don't know if you've ever had Korean pears, but they remind me so much of jicama, which is one of my favorite starches. I love jicama. And again, it's because I love the sound it makes when I, you know, crunching on jicama. And so I was like, oh, well, instead of using jicama for this slaw, I'll just use something slightly sweeter, a little bit more tender. And that would be the Korean pear. It's got a very mild dressing made with doenjang. Again, I love sneaking that ingredient into everything because it is, you know, it's got that umami that sort of hits you right here in the nose, but it is such a great pairing with sweeter flavors. And so it makes this kind of nice, very mild dressing for, I think, a fairly delicate slaw. But it's one that pairs well with so many different things. You can add it to a burger, you know, you can add it to a sandwich, you can have it on the side when you're having a barbecue. It's just a fantastic go-to salad.
I was already, as you're talking about it, I was like, oh, I could put that on a sandwich. I could put it on a burger. So really, like, so many things. That's what slaw is great for. You're like, well, I'm just going to put some slaw on top of that.
Exactly.
A whole meal there. I got some veggies in.
Yeah.
Well, there's a large variety to choose from this chapter. Cucumber kimchi, Napa cabbage kimchi, barely pickled kimchi, water kimchi. And for the salads, this kale and ramen salad sounds so yummy, using the crunch of your familiar childhood ingredient with ramen noodles to make kale more enticing for you. And we all need ways to make kale more enticing. There's a Brussels sprout salad and this Korean potato salad with scallion aioli. It just wraps this chapter up. Who doesn't love a potato salad? Get into it.
Yeah, that's a very popular banchan. I actually almost put it in the banchan chapter, but I was like, well, it's you know, technically a salad, but it's one of those random things where I think that, again, the Korean War had so much of an influence on Korean cuisine that we understand and know today. You know, Korean people, oh, what is this potato salad that everyone's eating, all the U.S. soldiers are eating? And so they kind of came up with their own version of it. And it's really good. Normally it has boiled eggs in it, but I use chickpeas, which I found to be such a great substitute for boiled eggs, and it gives you that protein. It gives you fiber, which of course eggs do not have, but it also kind of gives you a little bit of that flavor that I think, you know, when you're doing like an egg salad sandwich, I often just use chickpeas,
right?
And it turned out perfectly.
Oh, that's great. Well, chapter 5 brings us into soups and stews, probably always one of my favorite chapters in any book because they're just so comforting. And you open up with a story in this chapter about how every time you make the rice cake soup, you tell a story of how this soup reminds you of a particular moment, but then also how it reminds you of a more broad memory of mornings spent with your family over a piping hot bowl of soup. Please tell us about this soup and sort of what that brings up for you.
Yeah. So I think it's a tteokmandukguk recipe. And I wrote this and my editor was like, I think we have to take it out. And I was like, no, I feel very strongly about this story. And
why?
I love my editor. And, you know, she always like came around, you know, but she challenged me. You know, she did push back on things and this was one of them. And I just felt so strongly like, look, if people don't like this, then I don't think they'll like the whole rest of the book. I feel like, you know, this is the book is telling these pivotal moments in my life that happened around food, you know? And so this tteokmandukguk is a very traditional, actually it's just tteokguk, is very traditional Korean dish around New Year's. And my parents, they stopped celebrating Lunar New Year mostly and just celebrate the Western calendar New Year. I think it was just more convenient because they would get vacation time, you know, already from work and things like that. So we could celebrate it. And every new year, we would eat bakguk, which is rice cake soup. And, you know, usually it would have mandu, which is dumplings, which is why I call it tteok mandukguk, which is rice cake and dumpling soup in the cookbook. And one year, this is before I went vegan, it was right before my first wedding. And I went over to my parents' house because I wanted to eat tteokguk. I was like, oh, my mom is going to make me tteok mandukguk for New Year's. And I didn't cook again. So I went over to their house and she, you know, has this piping hot bowl, you know, huge bowl. In Korea, you know, when you eat soup, you get bowls much wider than your face. Okay. And so she has this huge bowl of tteokguk for me. And she kind of pushes it over across the table. But with it, she also pushes over an envelope. And I'm thinking, oh my God, my parents are going to give me 세뱃돈. You know, in Korean culture, when we were little, we would get money on New Year's Day too. So I'm like, oh my God, it's been like 15 years, but I guess I'm getting money this year. Maybe it's because I'm getting married or something. But I open the envelope and it's a Hallmark card. And in it is her handwriting. And she's basically telling me, we really don't want you to get married. We think it's a terrible idea and we don't think he's the right man for you. Now, this is about 3.5 months before my wedding. And I just remember, and it was signed both, you know, mommy and daddy. And I was just so furious. I was so angry that they ambushed me, you know? And I remember we got into a huge fight. And, you know, my father, he's a teddy bear when it comes to this sort of stuff. And he hates upsetting me. And so he's like, oh, okay, you're right. You know, love is all that matters. Like, that's what I kept saying. Love is the only thing that matters. But my mom, I will remember to this day, she would not agree. She just said nothing. And I just remember the look on her face and I, you know, stormed out of their home. I didn't eat any tteokguk. I was so mad. And of course they were 100% right. They were 100% right, as the ultimate demise of my marriage would prove. But it's just this idea that in my family, and particularly with my mom, if there was something difficult to talk about, if it was often paired with food, because they didn't know how to talk about strong emotions without that sort of, but we still love you and here's some food to prove it, you know? And in that situation, I wasn't accepting of their form of love. Mm-hmm. And I think it really hurt them. And of course, it ultimately hurt me. You know, we can debate whether I learned enough from my first marriage to make it all worthwhile. But, you know, I do often go back to that conversation because I so often wonder, like, well, what would have happened if I had just eaten that tteokguk that day instead of storming out?
Man, it's so powerful to think of that too. And when you're saying, you know, we can debate whether or not I learned, I mean, we all learn from whatever it is. Yeah. So, you know, the answer is yes, I feel, you know, you learn something, whether it's enough or not, right?
Yeah.
Something. Well, this chapter also boasts fermented soybean soup, fermented soybean stew, kimchi stew, silken tofu stew, potato stew. Potato stew is speaking my language. And, and as we're talking about, you know, them sharing your love with you, I'm just soup to me is also that warming, comforting thing as well. Mm-hmm. So it plays right into that seaweed soup and a potato leek soup in here. So lots of great things to choose from and perhaps have hard conversations over.
Yes. They're great for that. They facilitate excellent DTRs.
Yes, yes. And a chapter for everyone. Chapter 6 is noodles and pasta. And what are the Korean words? There's a couple of them used for referring to noodles.
There are a lot of different kinds of noodles, but the ones that I refer to at the opening of that chapter are guksu and myeon. Okay. And you will be familiar with this. For example, when you eat instant Korean noodles, you may call it ramen, but in Korean, it's called ramyeon, you know, ramyeon. So yes. Myeon refers to the noodle. Guksu is also a word for noodle. And I like to think that guksu usually refers to noodles like wheat-based noodles that are very skinny. So, you know, when I'm like making kimchi guksu, I'll use what looks to many people like angel hair pasta. It's a very skinny noodle. But honestly, like I did a lot of research on this. I asked my mom, I was like, what, like, is there a, like a rhyme or reason to when you use myeon, when you use guksu? And she's like, no, not really. Not that I know of. So it's a little bit hard, but in my experience, like, more often than not, when you're saying guksu, it does really refer to skinny noodles. When you're referring to myeon, you're thinking of something a little bit thicker, like ramyeon or jjajangmyeon. So that's kind of the rule that I go by.
Okay. Well, and you've got at the top of this chapter, you talk about the black soybean noodles, and there's a connection with your father and brother in a restaurant from your childhood. And I love the way you sort of vividly painted that picture for us of the restaurant. And you also mentioned it's one of the most popular Korean dishes. In your words, it's the stuff of K-pop legend. Why is this dish so popular? What is it made up of that that makes it so desirable?
You know, I think there are a lot of reasons it's very popular. I think, as I mentioned in the chapter, one of the most practical reasons it's popular is because it's so convenient. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to get jjajangmyeon in Korea. So they have an instant variety. If you've watched Parasite, the movie, there's that there's that iconic scene where she asks the cook to make jjapbaegeri, which is that instant noodles with a very dark sauce, a gravy. And then, of course, she ruins it all by adding like filet mignon to the top of it. Right. So that is the instant version of this classic dish. But in Korea, I was just reading an article the other day about this woman. She's like, every time we go to Korea, it wasn't an article. It was Crying at H-Mart, you know, another fantastic book.
Oh,
yeah. And she talks about every time they go to Korea, like literally the first thing they do is they order jjajangmyeon. And then somebody with a bicycle will come in and have two beautiful porcelain bowls of jjajangmyeon ready to go. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so popular. It's one of those things when you're too tired to cook, when you don't like want to do anything and you just want to sit there and drink and watch TV like after work. Yeah. One of the only foods that was available, you know, prior to the prevalence of Grubhub and food delivery as we know it in Korea was jjajangmyeon. That was one of the only things that was available via delivery. So it just became this like really popular food to eat after work if you were too tired or if you just come, you know, from a long travel, right? Like traditionally, jjajangmyeon is a little hard to explain because it's not technically Korean food.
Okay.
Many people, when they saw that it was the cover of my dish, they're like, well, it's not Korean. I'm like, yeah, well, it's not Chinese either. So I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. And this is the food that my father and I ate like every Sunday for like years. So it's a Korean Chinese hybrid dish. Okay. And the best way to explain it is if you walk into a Chinese restaurant and you ask for jjajangmyeon, they're going to look at you and be like, I don't know what you're talking about. If you go to a traditional Korean restaurant and you ask for jjajangmyeon, they're like, oh, we're not a Chinese restaurant. That's the response you're going to get. Yeah. So you need to find a Korean-owned Chinese restaurant. It's very specific. And the reason for that is jjajangmyeon is basically a Korean interpretation of Chinese-style noodles. So back in the day, somebody said, I want to make a Chinese restaurant in Korea. Uh-huh. And that's how sort of jjajangmyeon came to be.
Wow. And so that is that. Then that is... Was the restaurant that you went to in Chicago, was that a Korean-owned Chinese restaurant?
It was a Korean. And a lot of times I tell people, or it's a Chinese-owned Korean-style Chinese restaurant.
Sure.
The best way to tell if you are in the right place is if they speak Korean. If they know, A, that you are Korean before you tell them and they start speaking Korean to you, then you're probably in the right place.
Gotcha. That's a good indicator. Yes. Well, also in this chapter, we have knife cut noodles, cold buckwheat noodles, Korean glass noodles, kimchi noodles, angry penne pasta, spicy torn noodles, and there's an arrabbiata in here. What's the word before arrabbiata, though? I don't want to...
It's tteokbokki arrabbiata. And tteokbokki, if you're probably familiar with, it's one of the most popular Korean foods. Certainly, probably the most popular Korean street food. It's those spicy rice cakes that you often see in Korean food stalls. it is probably one of my more popular recipes, but here I wanted to make it using a kind of an Italian inspired sauce because, you know, that spicy red sauce, I'm like, well, you know, the Italians also have a spicy red sauce.
It's right. Right. Yep. Yeah. I love an arrabbiata sauce. So this is where there's a fusion here in some of the recipes with your in-laws, it seems. I think you speak of your father-in-law here at one point, your mother-in-law at another point. There's a dessert we'll get to. but this is one of those fusions, it seems like, yes?
Yeah. So when we first started dating, you know, Anthony's father is Roman Italian. And that, if you're at all familiar with Italy, like they have very specific cuisine tied to very specific regions of the country, which I think is very beautiful. And because of that, Anthony grew up eating a lot of just traditional Italian fare. And before he went vegan, he was somewhat unadventurous when it came to food. So he kind of just stuck to the same restaurants all the time, like the restaurants that, you know, he and his father would go to, sure, just these Italian Chicago restaurants.
Delicious. And
they're very, very good. Yeah. But it's like, we could do something not Italian sometimes, you know? Yep. But when we were first dating, we went to a lot of Italian restaurants, and there was just this one where they had this wonderful arrabbiata. And I remember like had this like little, you know, pepper on top, and it was super spicy and it was really good. And I was like, oh, well, I'll use that same sauce for tteokbokki and see what happens. And of course it was delicious.
Ah, so yummy. So yummy. And you just a moment ago, you were talking about street food, and that takes us into our next chapter, which is chapter 7, bar and street foods. And again, this one starts off with a bang here. Your story about running your first marathon and your father being there to see it. And I mean, I want to save some stuff for the reader because this is again, you're going to want to cook from this book, but also give yourself time to kind of curl up with it and read it as you would a book. I hope for your, I mean, do you have books out? Do you have books that are not cookbooks out?
No.
I see that in your future. I'm just saying, I'm not a fortune teller, but I could read a whole book from you for sure. That's that. I would love another cookbook too, but I'm just saying like the way you tell a story, man, it just gets me. And my heart felt this reading so hard. I felt this. It's so beautiful. And a runner, as if you didn't have enough going on already. She's taken on a running as well. You're running marathons. How many marathons have you run?
I've run 5 marathons.
Look at that. Look at that.
Yeah, I know. Are you a runner?
No. I've considered it a few times. I've done a few 5Ks and I'm like, you know, I think I'm good. I do some strength training. The running hasn't been so much my gig. But are you still a runner today?
Yeah, I still run. I'm not training for anything at the moment.
I wondered if you had anything coming up.
Yeah, I will likely run a half marathon in the spring if everything lines up, but my running has finally gotten to a point where I feel very confident and I'm very excited about this upcoming season.
That's awesome. Do you have you traveled around to do those marathons, or were they in Chicago? So what's your favorite marathon that you've done?
For me, it's not so much about the city that I'm in or the landscape, although that does play a role. But I mean, honestly, when you're running 26 miles, you're not really paying attention.
I can't even imagine.
and you'd be surprised just how beautiful even the most mundane places can ultimately be at the right time of year. My favorite marathon is probably Chicago. I have run it 3 times.
Okay.
And it's because the marathon does such a great job of visiting all of the different neighborhoods and boroughs of Chicago. And of course, because I grew up there, I lived there for 43 years, it's so nostalgic for me. And there's, you know, 40,000 people running the race, and then, you know, anywhere from 1 million or more can come out to be cheering you on. And that sort of energy is really difficult to replicate, you know, other than in some of these larger cities. And it's flat. That's another big thing for me. Sure. I have run some fairly hilly marathons. I did the half marathon in New York City last year, and geez, running up the Manhattan Bridge.
Yeah, like my husband did that one. He doesn't do a bunch of marathons, but he's done a couple, and that was one that, because we lived in New York for 20 years. We were in Atlanta now, but we were there for 20 years, and he got the lottery 1 year, and he was like, well, I guess I'm doing this.
Do it. Yeah. It's intense.
Oh my goodness. Well, speaking of them streets, flat streets, curvy streets, all them things. We've got some awesome street food and bar foods here. If someone wanted to make something from this chapter, a street food or a bar food to share at a party. What are a couple items you might suggest?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I would say, like, I really like, I think the tteokbokki skewers are in there, the curry tteokbokki skewers. I remember a couple of days ago, I posted on my Twitter a picture of pesto tteokbokki. I made a lot of pesto because I had like 7 pounds of basil that I was like, okay, I need to do something with this. And so I made all this pesto and I was like, I really don't want to eat this with pasta. And I was like, well, I have some leftover tteokbokki or, you know, karetteok, which is the rice cakes for tteokbokki. And I was like, why not just do that? And it came out delicious. And I posted a picture of it. And there were some people who were like, I'm a hardcore conservative tteokbokki fan. You can only eat it this way. And I'm like, all right, that's fine.
Go How nice for it. You. Great. Yeah, go for great. It.
But for me, I always loved like experimenting with all different kinds of flavors because rice cake is such a neutral thing. It's just like pasta. Like it just absorbs whatever you put around it, you know? So why does it have to be limited to the two traditional ways? There are two traditional ways to prepare tteokbokki. And I was like, I'm just going to add whatever I want. And I'm like, I love Indian food. Like I love Indian food. So I was like, just add some great curry around it and then see what happens. And I mean, because you can put it on the skewers, they're just like a really fun party food, you know, like eating things like this. It's like, you know, like kind of like a corn dog. It's fun. And so it's great. And the sauce is phenomenal. I mean, you can use it for rice. You can use it for potatoes or vegetables. But again, why not use it for rice cakes?
I love good sauce. Sauce it up. We got lots of great stuff in this chapter. Seaweed rice roll, Oma's egg rolls, tofu and kimchi, rice balls. And again, you did all the photography, right?
Did you? I did.
It's so gorgeous. I mean, it just makes you the rice ball. This one's broken open. You just want to like eat it off the page. Bulgogi wasabi melt, Korean barbecue, black bean burgers, Korean style toast. There's two variations of fried stuffed pancakes with cheesy and sweet. And then those skewers too. And I love a good skewer. So this chapter really, really hits it home with some great stuff. I think people would have fun with at parties. But I just want to make that sandwich for myself. we come into the main event here. We've got main dishes with chapter 8. You mentioned again how there's really no main dishes in Korean food. They're all a style of banchan. And you say this chapter is full of ones you would bring out to really impress, to get the oohs and ahs from the crowd. So we have a grilled steak, barbecue short ribs, spicy, crunchy garlic wings. And there's a photo here of the spicy, crunchy tofu garlic in this book. Again, with the photos, it has me drooling. I can't wait to make it. But what's a recipe you found from this chapter that sort of receives the biggest oohs and ahs, the biggest reaction when you bring it to the table?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I would say it's either that tofu, the spicy garlic crunchy tofu, that is hands down my most popular recipe. I see somebody make it at least once a day.
I feel like you're going to see it on my Instagram very soon.
It's great. It's so good. I actually just made it the other day using cauliflower instead of tofu. And the reason for that is I do like to create a balanced situation when people come over for a dinner party.
Yeah.
And I'd already made the braised tofu, which is the other one that I would say are kind of the two showstoppers out of that chapter. And I was like, well, I already have tofu here. It's a good protein. And I have a whole head of cauliflower that's just sitting here. So I'm just going to do the same thing that I would do for kampung tofu and just do it in cauliflower. It was phenomenal. And it's really that sauce. I talk about in that head note, you know, it's a take on kampunggi, which is, again, something you cannot find in a Korean restaurant and you cannot find in a Chinese restaurant. You can only find a Korean Chinese restaurant. So a lot of times people will eat it with jajangmyeon. And it's like there was this one place in Chicago where they were just famous for kampunggi. I mean, and the pictures on the wall would be how many, you know, they were usually made with chicken. How many wings did these people eat? And a lot of times we'd go in there and be like, why don't they just sell the sauce? I mean, I would just chug the sauce by itself because it was so good. And eventually they did end up just, you know, jarring the sauce and they would sell it out of their restaurant. And so this sauce is so great. Again, you can do it with just steamed vegetables would be fine. You don't need to go through the 9 yards of, you know, frying your tofu or cauliflower, whatever. You could just steam it or boil it and then just have some of the sauce and then pour it over there. And it's so, so good.
Oh, I love it. Sauce really just, it changes everything. It can just, you know, take a meal from sort of crap to credible in 5 minutes. Really,
I love that. Crap to incredible.
I mean, it's just, it's so good. And this chapter goes further. We've got sweet and sour mushrooms, a nutrient packed bowl, a power bowl, dumplings, also another to-do list here on my to-do list from here. There's a tofu hot pot, fried rice, rice porridge. And my goodness, I mean, I want to be in your home because this is the marriage of all marriages. I think there is this lasagna with gochujang red sauce. Tell us about this lasagna, please.
Yes. So I think I put in there, like, I actually give a rating of difficulty for each of my recipes.
You that do, one, which I really appreciate too. So people can be like, no, no, not tonight. Or like, oh yes, I'm taking my Saturday afternoon to do this.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so this one is going to take you more than an afternoon. It'll probably take you like 48 hours. To make this dish, to be honest. So I think I probably call this practice makes perfect, which is my moniker for like really hard. So back before I went vegan, I had a friend who came over to stay with me and I wanted to impress her. So I actually reached out to a partner of mine at the firm who had been vegan for many years. And I asked him for some advice on how to make good vegan food. And he told me that oftentimes he uses cashews to make like a cashew cream, which any vegan cook will know, like that's one of the staples of our, you know, diet, right? We eat lots of cashews in many varied forms, right? Yep. And so I kind of did that. Like I took that piece of advice and I really wanted to make a lasagna. And the reason for that, of course, is because my boyfriend at the time is Italian American. And so I was like steeped in learning all different kinds of Italian cuisine for my boyfriend. And so I kind of like wanted to make a vegan lasagna using cashew cream. And because I knew nothing about vegan food, like I just like kind of came up with flavors and things like based upon like what I knew, you know, of flavors. And so then I made like this delicious like bechamel using tofu because I knew tofu, you know, and then I made this like avocado thing because I was like, well, avocados are creamy and fatty and they're vegan. So like I kind of like made this lasagna and I fed it to not just my friend, but to everyone in my Italian side of the family who are not vegan. And they're like, this is spectacular. Like whatever this situation is, like is amazing. And so when I went vegan, I made it many, many times. And always like people would be like, this is incredible. So I knew if I ever were to write a cookbook, I would include this lasagna recipe in it. There are a couple of recipes in the book that I had been hoarding for years and years and years because I was like, I got to include it in the cookbook so I can't share it. And this
it'll have a place.
Exactly. And this was one of them.
Oh, it found its home. I love that. Yeah. I love that about, you know, content creators are holding on to things where they're like, I can't put this out. This deserves a special, like this special needs place. A special place for this. So I love that it made it into the book. And before we wrap up, speaking of special things, before we wrap up the main dishes chapter, can you tell us about Oma's casserole?
Oh yeah. Okay. So like I talk about this in the beginning of the book, again, with the, I wanted to be like the Seavers and we were definitely not the Seavers, you know, the Growing Pains family. Mm-hmm. And the thing is we always ate Korean food and that really drove me nuts. Cause I was like, I want to eat what all my friends are eating. They were always eating casserole and, you know, meatloaf and Salisbury stuff. And like, you know, and so every once in a while, my mother would indulge us and she would make her take on American food. And so she had this one casserole dish, which I loved. And it was like, so like 1950s, like you take like a, you know, Campbell's soup, cream of something, mix it with like frozen green beans, throw some pasta in there, mozzarella cheese. And there you go. There's your casserole, right? Mm-hmm. She would make that for us every once in a while. And it was just like always my favorite. And I love casseroles. I think they're brilliant. I think lasagna is basically a very, very fancy, hard casserole. but like, so I wanted to make a version of that that still tasted just like what I did growing up, but was vegan. And of course, that does start with a cream of mushroom that is vegan, and it's delicious. And I love making this dish. It takes a little bit of love. It does take a little bit of time, but it's always one of my favorite things to eat.
And a casserole, you really can't go wrong. And you usually have, depending on how many people you have in the house, you have leftovers. So then you've got maybe some lunch or a meal prep situation. You can turn anything into meal prep, everybody. Even a casserole, it can work for you in your favor. Chapter 9 takes us to sweets. And you talk about persimmons in the beginning of the chapter. Tell the listeners about your love of persimmons.
I love persimmon. Oh, I love persimmon. I mean, it is one of the perfect foods, in my opinion. Persimmon, if you haven't had it before, there are two popular kinds. There's the, you know, Fuyu persimmon, which is like the kind that looks like a squat little tomato, maybe, or even like a miniature pumpkin, maybe. That's what it looks like. And it is hard, so it doesn't take as much time to ripen. And you're supposed to eat it while it's still kind of crunchy. It's a little bit less sweet, and it's kind of got a nutty sort of flavor. It's still really, really good. I feel like pumpkin is probably the best sort of analogy in terms of flavor, shape, color, except for the fact that pumpkins are much bigger. The other one is just this is the kind that I grew up eating. I didn't even know that Fuyu persimmons were a thing until much later when I was kind of doing research on persimmons for a recipe, and I started seeing them sort of all over in Western grocery stores. But the other kinds, they're much larger, and they look like oblong tomatoes, and they'll be hard in the beginning. And if you try eating one while they're hard, you will say, I don't know what this lady's talking about. She must be smoking something, because this is literally the worst thing I've ever put in my mouth. We made that mistake once with my husband. I misjudged the ripeness of one of them, and I gave it to him. He'd never had persimmon, and he spit it out, and he's like, why would anyone ever eat this? You know? And then, you know, a couple weeks later, I gave him a fully ripe one, and he was like, this is literally the best thing I've ever eaten in my life. It's hard to describe, but it's kind of like, think of the best nectarine or peach you've ever had. It's just like, you know, the sticky ooze, you know, of that. And then, you know, kind of marry that with the texture of a tomato. I think that's like the best way to describe it. I love persimmons.
I don't think I've had hit my persimmon moment yet where I've thought I need the right one. I need to have the right one. I don't dislike them, but I think I need to have that.
You have to have that moment. Yeah. And usually you can't find the good ones unless you're at a Korean grocery store.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what's a sweet that you knew hands down had to be in this chapter when you started putting it together?
The desserts chapter kind of came about because, again, my editor was like, you have a lot of desserts like here. And I was like, yeah, I love baking, you know? And I like challenging myself in that way, especially vegan baking.
Sure.
I had only just started baking when I went vegan because my, you know, soon to be father-in-law, he was an avid baker, and I really just wanted to impress him and my boyfriend. And so I was baking all these different things. And then I went vegan, and I was like, are you going to take all my butter and eggs away from me? And now what am I supposed to do? And it was just a challenge. I would say one thing that I knew had to go in there, which is not a very Korean sweet, is the madeleines.
I think you mean the sexy cookie.
And I talk about how my favorite Korean drama of all time, you know, Samsun, she's a Korean baker in that drama, and she talks about how madeleines are a sexy cookie. And madeleines have this sort of kind of storied place in Korean bakeries. They are viewed as sort of like the height of elegance in terms of a cookie. Okay. And so I wanted to make it. It's very hard to make French pastries without dairy and eggs, but you know, with the madeleine, aquafaba really does such a wonderful job of creating that lovely bounce that you want with those cookies. And they came out just perfect. I was so proud of them. Yeah,
they look amazing in the photo.
Pretty. Yeah. They taste really good too.
Do you need to get that shape? How do you get the shape from those?
So you do need like a tray that is designed for Madeline. Okay. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense. I'd rather have a tray to put them in like that than be trying to like
to try to take a toothpick.
Yeah, give me a break. My goodness. We've got some twisty sugar donuts in here that are calling my name. They look so good.
That is very popular in my house.
My gosh. And we can't really make donuts in this house because it's me and my husband, we'll just eat donut after donut. It's like we have to, if we make them, we've got to make them. And then we've got to have a place, we can have one and then have a place that we're taking them to and getting them out of the house, essentially.
Exactly.
We have a chocolate sweet potato cake, chocolate persimmon cupcakes, Dayton ginger tea, sweet rice cakes, lemon and coriander blueberry muffins, sweet maple roasted corn tea, chocolate chip, is it pot cookie?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that's sweet red bean paste, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. We've got chocolate covered shortbread sticks and mother-in-law's eclair cake. This looks so good. It's got the layers and an addition of chocolate cake. Tell us more about this one.
So again, that's obviously not Korean in any way, shape, or form. Sure. But my mother-in-law, she's very much like, in my view, what I think of like, oh, she grew up in America in the 1950s. And I love that because there's no pretension in her cooking. It's like, I'm going to take some shortcuts wherever the F I can take them because I don't have time. You know, like I've got two boys running around the house and what's wrong with using the devil's food cake box or what's wrong with using instant pudding? What's wrong and calling it an eclair? Like that's basically where this came. Yeah. And she used to make this for us before we went vegan. And it was always like, oh my God, your mom made eclair cake. Yay. We were like so excited about it. I actually preferred it to his father's tiramisu. God rest him. Sorry, Robert. I loved her eclair cake. And when she told me how to make it, I was like, that's not even a cake. Right. And it's definitely not an eclair.
You're like, wait, go back. Did you tell me the right recipe? Do you want to go back and try again?
Really? Like, there's no baking?
Oh my gosh.
Like, no, it's just like a bunch of cookies with instant pudding on it and some melted chocolate. That's basically the cake, you know? And so I added a layer of cake so that I could feel comfortable calling it a cake. But it's so good. I make it all the time for like birthdays and celebrations because it is fairly easy to make and it's always delicious.
Yeah. Oh, and it just looks phenomenal. And from here, you wrap up the book with the story of a trip to South Korea with your parents in 2019. And this is the moment, I think, if a reader hasn't realized it already, this is this whole book. I mean, it's a love letter. And it's a love letter. And your cooking is to your, it's just to your mother and your father, to your whole family, a love letter to cooking. And I knew it through the entire book, but like this ending really put a beautiful bow on the story and sharing the history of your family and the relationships and their past and their history, right? So it's not just about even your direct history with them, but like what came before that even. And I read the last few pages again in tears. Thanks a lot, Joanne. And I just felt so grateful you shared your story with us in such a just a profound and beautiful way, really. So thank you for opening up and thank you for sharing your story so honestly with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much for reading that last chapter. I feel like most people don't get to it.
Oh, and they need to read it.
I am very always grateful because it is the chapter that I'm probably most proud of as a writer. And it's the reason we went to Korea was for the book. Cause I felt it was very important to not just have my parents feel seen through the writing of the book, but also for them to physically see me see them.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, I will go wherever you want me to go, Daddy. If you want to show me where you grew up, I'll go. If you want to show me where you went to elementary school, I'll go. Mm-hmm. I'll go everywhere you want me to go. Because I remember my mom's like telling my dad, she doesn't want to see that. That's a waste of time. Why would she want to go? I'm like, no, Amma. I want to see everything. And same with you. You take me wherever you want. And I think that was really important. And I'm really glad that I was able to do that for the book, but also for my parents.
I love that. And as we're saying that, when you're saying you don't think people get to the end of that book and they read that, I want to repeat this to everyone. You want to cook out of this book, but you also want to grab yourself a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, perhaps a sexy cookie, and you want to sit and you want to read the parts of this book that are not recipes. You want to read it like you would sit down and read a book because it's well worth it. And this is where we get to your book brag moment. So what is something about this book that you're most proud of when it comes to this book? You gave us a moment just now, but what's something that you're most proud of?
I would say I'm very proud of the photography. Yes. I think that has always been a little bit of an imposter syndrome thing for me because I'm certainly not a professionally trained cook, but I'm also not a professionally trained photographer. It was just something that I kind of fell into like randomly, I think. And I was really, I'll be so candid. I was so nervous when I submitted the photos for the book that my editor was going to be like, these suck. You need to find a professional photographer and do them all over again. Like I was so freaking nervous that that was going to be the response. Oh my gosh. Like, I was like, they're going to make me hire a photographer and do it all over again. I know they are. But it wasn't that at all. It's been quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. And that's very rewarding to me because it is like, wow, like people actually really like the photography on top. In fact, a lot of people are like, I don't even cook the recipes. I just bought it for the pictures. And I think that's really cool. I will say, I mean, hats off to the art director at Avery, my publisher. She did such a beautiful job of really making them even way more beautiful than the original photos were and really shining a light on kind of just how pretty Korean food can be.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I dream of taking photos like this. So hats off. Well done. Applause, applause. And I'm running out of time here with you. So I would still love to do this rapid fire round of questions if you're game for it.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll go fast. Here we go. Number one, hot sauce or barbecue sauce?
Barbecue.
Food on a skewer or a tiny spoon?
Tiny spoon.
Favorite spice to cook with?
Gochugaru.
Next goal is a runner?
Boston Marathon.
Ah, nice. If you were to make a vegan taco right now, what would you put on it?
Kampung tofu.
And cupcakes or donuts?
Oh, donuts.
What? That's a hard one, right?
Yeah, this is a really hard one.
What is something in your morning routine that you can't live without?
Running.
Kitchen tool you can't live without?
Oh, geez, my knife. I don't know if that's a tool.
No, that's a good one. Yeah. Favorite shape of pasta?
Rigatoni.
What's the highest number of things you have fit into a Korean hot pot?
Oh, 25 and a half.
There you go. A place you'd like to visit that's on your dream list?
That's on my dream list. I'd really love to go to Australia one day.
Me two. And you're the second person in the last week to say this on this podcast. Yeah. I'm number three. So we're doing a group trip.
I'll go together.
A group vegan trip to Australia. Do you have a shout out to a small vegan business recently that you've been frequenting or enjoying or just one that you love?
You know, I don't have a small vegan business. We just kind of moved to LA. So I'm still kind of getting the hang of things here. I will say, I think I mentioned earlier that book that I was reading. It's a manuscript on bread, and it's literally called Bread, only spelled with just E. So it's B-R-E-D.
Okay.
And it's a reference to the author's name, Ed. And it's an entirely vegan sourdough book.
Okay.
And I'm very excited for it to come out. I have always struggled with sourdough, which is why you don't see a recipe of that in my book. And I'm really excited about it. And he spends a very long time talking about his vegan journey and the process of veganizing or keeping vegan some of these beautiful bread recipes. And I cannot say enough good things about it. So I think of authors sort of as a small business. I'm really
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it's B-R-E-D is
yes.
the name of it? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll be looking out for it. Your last question. Is it too late to find your dream job in your 40s?
That is a categoric no.
Exactly.
It's never too late.
Never too late. I love it. Well, listen, Joanne, please tell everyone where they can find you on social media and the World Wide Web.
Yeah, you can find me at The Korean Vegan pretty much everywhere. You can also find me on www.thekoreanvegan.com. But otherwise, I'm on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, all of those places at The Korean Vegan.
All the things, all the places. And this book has really made me think about food in a new way and have a new respect for the foods we are so lucky to have in our lives and see how we easily all sort of take it for granted. So it's really a thoughtful read, and food has history, and you've shared that with us in such a powerful way. Everyone, you must, if you haven't already, go get yourself a copy of The Korean Vegan. Everywhere books are sold, you won't be sorry. I promise you, Joanne. Thank you for your time. It was an honor, a privilege, and a joy to enjoy your company today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Keep On Cooking. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a review if you like the podcast. It helps a lot.
Yeah. And get more information on the podcast, Dustin's Cookbooks, the Vegan Roadie series, and sign up for our newsletter at veganroadie.com.
And of course, follow us at The Vegan Roadie on all social media platforms. Now get in the kitchen and keep on cooking. And hey, remember, it's nice to be nice. This has been a Muzzy Cat production.